Good. Good to see you. Hi, Tia.
I'm doing okay, too.
Katie says we have 30 minutes, so go ahead.
There was, a collective gulp we could all hear from the insurance lobby when you give your presentation there about the premium tax issue. Is that something you actually expect to come back as an issue this year, or were you just using it as an example, but like we heard?
Both.
Okay, so we should expect it to be...
I would hope so. It's okay. Good. It's good policy.
Okay.
I think it comports well with conservative values that both the House and Senate share.
Is there legislation filed or anything to that effect at this point?
It's a proposal that I think you'll see move forward in the Senate and hopefully in the House as well.
Speaking of insurance, is there a designated point person for workers'
comp? I think Senator Bradley will have a leadership role on that issue, but many senators have strong, compelling ideas in that arena, including Senator Simpson and others. So I think that's how we'll proceed. My goal is in that issue that we focus on the premiums being paid by business owners. And in the Senate, we want to look at the whole system on how rates are determined and make sure that proposed rate increases are in fact justified and are being arrived at in a fair and appropriate manner.
Along the lines of the same concerns that Judge Gevers expressed, is that what you're saying?
As I understand, her opinion dealt with the practical procedure parts of a proposed rate increase being considered. And that's important, but what I'm talking about has more to do with how a rate amount is determined. And, for instance, it was a little over 14%. How did they arrive at 14%? And this is a case where it appears that if the agency and responsible for promulgating rates had used this time to modify their procedures rather than appeal, then it would have delayed an enormous cost on Florida businesses. So I want to look at the entire workers' comp process, and there's a lot of focus on claimants' fees, and we should look at that, but I don't hear many people talking about defense fees. And defense fees are actually more than claimants' fees, if you look at the total amount of fees in the system. And I have render no judgment on whether that's appropriate or not appropriate in terms of the amounts. That'll be for the committee process to determine. But I don't know that I've ever heard anyone talk about defense fees, and it turns out they're actually significantly more than the claimants' fees in the comp system. And then I want to have a focus not just on addressing or reacting to the Supreme Court ruling, but looking at the entire system, because my commitment are to business owners, to small business entrepreneurs, to other in the construction industry, to make sure that the financial burden on them is at a level as it should be, and not based on other outside forces.
Sir, you just in the earlier thing talked about how the House is not somehow more conservative than the Senate, but you closed by saying that you're going to offer competing conservative visions. I wonder if you could tell me briefly, describe for me, what is the Senate's brand of conservatism?
Well, I gave you some specific examples, and I think that's actually a better way to address it, because it's more tangible and verifiable. I think having policies that treat Florida's consumers fairly, I believe that's a conservative principle. I also think that legislation and policies that honor the sovereignty of the individual, I believe that's conservative as well. So I've served in both the House and the Senate, and it's just one of these narratives. I think it's a mythical narrative that sort of arises, and it's kind of this hackneyed default setting when people are positioning or writing stories or looking at their, like, oh, there's the conservative House versus the moderate Senate. And I just think the facts belie that characterization. And I think that you're going to see very, very conservative proposals come out of the Senate on many issues, and that that reasonable men and women of goodwill can promulgate conservative ideas in a different manner. And I gave some examples this afternoon of where I think the Senate actually had the more conservative position, which didn't prevail in the House. And I mentioned examples of policies that I think we both share, you know, school choice, fiscally conservative policies, keeping taxes low. I think both the House and Senate share.
Can you talk about your strategy when it comes to appointing Senator Bracey as chairman of the Criminal Justice Committee, particularly when it comes to your focus on juvenile justice versus some of the criminal justice topics that have maybe got more attention in the past, like guns and stand your grounds? Can you just talk about why you appointed him and what
Sure.
you hope to accomplish through that committee?
My decision to appoint Senator Bracey to chair criminal justice was a two-part decision. The first part, and they're independent of each other. The first part was I reached a conclusion based on his reputation in the House, based on my personal observation of him in the House, and my talking with him. I first made the decision that I wanted him to have the opportunity to chair a committee in the Senate. So that was part one. Then the second part of the decision was then to meet with him and talk with him and find out from him what area of public policy most interested him, and then what I thought would be a good fit based on his interest. And he made it clear to me that he had served, I believe, for 4 years in some capacity in criminal justice, I think as the ranking member. And so this was his top issue that he was passionate about, and it seemed like a good fit based on his background and experience. But he has an expansive portfolio of assignments. If you look at his committee assignments, he's on banking and insurance, you know, he's on judiciary, he's on appropriations, he's on regulated industries. I mean, those are very coveted spots in the Senate, and that reflects the ability he has based on part one of my decision making, that he has extraordinary capabilities and I think will be a leader in the Senate. So that was my thought process on how I arrived at that particular chair. But if his interest had been in something different, it's quite possible that, in fact, I think likely that he may have chaired a different area. But he made a strong case on his qualifications for that committee, his experience and his passion. And I think we both share a commitment to, you know, as I say, you know, we should not, we will not tolerate serious wrongdoing by young people, but at the same time, let's not criminalize adolescents. And I think there are other areas in criminal justice as well, you know, making sure that if someone's driver's license is suspended, it should be related to driving because it's your driver's license. And we now are suspending the driver's license of people, of citizens in Florida for activities wholly unrelated to driving. And that's an issue Senator Brandis has worked on, and I think that we can make some progress on that. And I know he has some of his own ideas as well that we'll continue to work on.
Do you anticipate that some of the issues that have been heard in criminal justice in the past might not this year, the gun bills, the stand your ground bills, and is that okay with you?
I don't know, because we've only got a few bills so far that have come to the president's office for referencing. So those referencing decisions I'll make once I see what the actual bills look like.
Related to that, do you think that some of the things that you just mentioned will get more traction? Some of those, like you said, Senator Brandis's idea about the driver's licenses, and not to mention juvenile justice stuff that you talked about, but will get more traction than they have in the past, because they've been out there before. And then related to that, do you think that those those seem to be like smaller pieces of something that a lot of even businesses have been business groups have been talking about, which is, you know, larger sentencing reform across the whole spectrum of criminal justice, not just juvenile justice, and not just this one area. Is that feasible during, you know, the next 2 years, say, or is it going to have to be done sort of like piecemeal? Sounds like.
I mean, everything is incremental, but I would hope we'd have an ambitious agenda there. And I'll give you another example. We have cases where someone has had a criminal charge for writing a bad check. Shouldn't write a bad check. If you write a bad check, you need to go make sure it's paid and you know, whatever the sanctions are for that, you know, as appropriate. But where that something that happened, you know, when they were 21 or 22 years old, and now they're applying for a job in a certain field, and this is essentially a bar to employment. And that's not being tough on crime. That's putting up obstacles in the way of people getting up and going to work every day, like we all have to. So I think that's another area that will be looked at. And what makes this so rewarding and why I put so much time and thought into those committees and into Senator Bracey's role in that is you're seeing a consensus develop between groups that, and I'm talking about a traditional description. This isn't my description. This is how, you know, everybody gets put into a little box. So I'm describing the box as I found it, which is that if you talk about these issues on the conservative side, you know, you can be railed against as soft on crime or you're not backing law enforcement, which isn't true because a lot of these ideas come from law enforcement. And then on the Democratic side, sometimes those ideas have been dismissed as being too moderate or too liberal. And what you see is a developing consensus among particularly libertarian-leaning conservatives that a degree of skepticism and wariness is warranted in all parts of the human experience, including some of the things that we do in the name of criminal justice. And so, you know, you'll see states like North Carolina and Texas. I mean, one of the best speeches, if you want to reread a really good, interesting speech, and it's not just talk, it's facts of what he did, is Governor Rick Perry in Texas. You know, things that you would not typically associate with a conservative Southern Republican governor. So those are the kind of things where I think there's a growing consensus in both parties to make sure that obviously we have dangerous people incarcerated and we want to keep our crime rate low. But at the same time, you know, having people serve time in prison for technical violations of probation that could have been dealt with in another way, it's not making us safer. And, you know, and I talked about this, when you look at our incarceration rates compared to other countries, you know, it's pretty startling.
President Negron, switching gears a little bit.
Yeah.
There's a movement in the House by your counterpart to sort of rail against lower levels of government lobbying here in Tallahassee and paying for lobbyists. I wanted to ask if that's a viewpoint that you share, and in particular, or as an example, how you feel about Martin County having private lobbyists they pay for up here when they have such a powerful advocate as a Senate president?
First of all, I completely respect Speaker Corcoran's interest in that issue and his commitment to make the process better and function in a way that he feels is more appropriate. My personal view, since you asked the question, is I don't have an objection to local governments making their decisions. You know, my job is to serve in the state Senate and to work on Senate issues within my jurisdiction. And so while I respect his concern, my personal view is that if a county or a city or municipality feels like it's in their best interest to have professional help to redress grievances, which that's what we're talking about, then I would defer to them on that decision.
Say on your higher education initiative,
yeah.
$1 billion more for higher ed.
Over 2 years.
That is still a doable option, even if
absolutely.
Money is going to.
I always knew money would be tight and difficult, but as I've said, we have an $82 billion budget, and I know from being in the private sector and working with clients, it's not at all unusual for a company and whether it's in the news business or any business, to move around 5%, 3% of resources to address a particular priority. And so if even if you just did 3% of an $82 billion budget, that's $2.5 billion. And that's five times more than what I'm asking for in a one-year commitment in higher ed. So I think that it's going to require us to do an intensive budget review. And Senator Latvala talked about that today at the when we met with the chairs of the committees, that he's going to ask every committee chair to engage in that intensive budget review and make sure we're not just rubber stamping the priorities of yesterday, that we're focusing on today's priorities, and then also having them, people with local projects, to come to Tallahassee to make a case for their project. So I think that there's sufficient revenue within money we have available to make that investment in higher education. And while it's certainly preliminary, and we don't know what the future is going to hold, obviously, but the Medicaid enrollment numbers were down a little. K through 12, I think, was down about 10,000, which you know, in the overall system isn't that significant. But I'm just optimistic that we can look at the entire budget and say, this is a priority. And otherwise, I don't think we're worthy of the title appropriators if we can't move around 3% of the budget.
It looks like the revenue estimating conference is going to add somewhere in the neighborhood of $140 million. Does that change your view of the budget substantially? And do you share Speaker Corcoran's contention that we may be in a shortfall regardless of what those numbers say?
I would agree that the $140 million does not significantly change our budget responsibilities, although I would rather have it on the positive than the other way. And I do agree with the Speaker that particularly in the out years, even as early as not this budget year we're going to write for, but the next budget year, there are challenges. And so I think we have to be very cautious in how we budget. And I agree with Speaker Corcoran that our budget process this year should be, you know, very thorough, and there should be a review of everything in the budget. Yes, ma'am.
I see that there is a session on nursing home care in the Medicaid managed care program, and I know that the nursing home industry has been maybe potentially looking to get carved out of the program. So I wanted to get a comment on that, and then follow up with, there's also a lengthy presentation on the cost savings in that program. So I wanted to ask you how you felt about that.
From when I chaired HHS appropriations to chairing full appropriations, I've always had a very strong interest in our nursing homes. I have visited many, many nursing homes, and this is Senator Benequisto's line, so I give her credit for it. She calls it the residents of nursing homes are the women who've shaped our communities. And our a typical resident of a nursing home in Florida is an 85-year-old woman. So these are the citizens that we're talking about that we have a responsibility to ensure that they're treated with dignity and respect and in a way that we all can be proud of. So I ask Senator Flores to look at the entire issue of managed care and long-term care. We're coming up toward the end of the first five-year contract. Speaking for myself, I have no intention of just rubber stamping another 5 years. I think that we need to get facts together. I view the committee as a jury, and they should call witnesses, and we should hear the entire story. Has it worked? Has it saved money? Has it improved the quality of care? One of the states that I visited back when President Herodopoulos appointed me to chair HHS appropriations, and then later when we did Medicaid reform, was I went to Arizona. And in Arizona, the managed care companies and the nursing homes have a system where the nursing homes appreciate the role of managed care in helping people age in place in their local communities. And then the nursing homes appreciate the fact that the payments are made to them in a timely manner for their services. And so that has worked in that state. I don't have an opinion yet because I haven't seen the facts as to whether that would describe the Florida experience. I don't know. That's why I want to find out. So I'm going to be watching that, and I have asked her to carefully study that issue and then have her committee present evidence to say it's working and we should continue exactly as is, or it's working but here's some changes that need to be made, or how are you really going to save money in a responsible way once someone's in a nursing home. And so we should consider going back to the system before, where you know, the state simply had contracts with nursing homes and paid them directly. So that is a very an area that I have a strong interest in. And from what I've heard and in looking at their agenda, they're going to hear from all sides on that issue. And then, you know, I'll wait to see what recommendation they make.
Savings. I see in Latvala's committee, you know, as part of that conversation, it's the cost savings in that managed care mandate and a discussion on block grants. You said you didn't want to just rubber stamp it, but how do you feel?
On long-term care or on?
On just the extension of the program in general.
Of Medicaid, of Medicaid managed care?
And the block, and should
I would, I block grants? I would love to explore the concept of block grants, and I think with President-elect Trump and with Dr. Price, who's a member of Congress from Georgia, who I do not know personally, but I've followed his career and have heard him make comments about being willing to consider having Florida be able to manage the program in a way that fits our state best, rather than the one-size-fits-all where we can't make any changes without the federal government. So I actually consider it to be an extraordinary opportunity that we may have, and I'm hopeful we may have in Florida, to have a block grant program where we could build our own Medicaid program from the ground up and do it in a way that empowers our neighbors and friends who get their health care through Medicaid.
Going back to education, when you did your tour of the various universities in the spring, I believe, one of the things that you seemed interested in was block tuition. Is that still on the table? What other policies are you interested in for higher ed?
Okay. In the area of tuition, my goal, my policy goal, is informed by the following circumstance. We met many students, and they tend to be at universities where a higher percentage of the students work 30 or 40 hours a week. So we met students, so this is not anecdotal, we have this information, and our experience reflects the information. So we met students who are taking 12 hours, because that's the minimum to be full-time, and they're doing it because they don't want to pay the extra cost and cannot afford to pay the extra cost between 12 and 15. So if I'm doing my math correctly, if you do 12 times 8, I think is 96. So you're now not graduating in 4 years. You need a fifth year to graduate. That's one reason why our graduation rate isn't as good as it should be, as high as it should be. So I don't want the universities to be hit with a decrease in revenue. In fact, just the opposite. I want them to do well. But I don't want there to be a financial disincentive for a student to be a full-time. And I know when I went to college, you were a full-time student. You could take between 12 and 18 hours, and it was the same price. You know, if you took over 18, it was kind of like, well, now that's so high that we're going to charge you an extra amount. But I would love to see us have a more predictable guideline on how we charge for tuition, because it concerns me when I see students who are happy to take 15 hours but they can't afford the difference in cost. So we're working in ways to resolve that.
What other policy proposal interests you, though? In addition to that,
yeah, I mean, I'll rattle them off quickly. I mean, because we've talked about them. I would want to see the top level of Bright Futures academic scholar level be 100% of tuition, plus $300 a stipend per semester for books. We want to increase our Florida Student Access Grant so we can cover more students who have need-based financial aid. I'd like to see us have a pool of funds to do two things. Like the analogy I've used is, I don't want to take a salt shaker and shake it on the university system. You know, here's $200 million more dollars into the current system. I don't have an interest in that. I want to say, here's targeted increases. And the two that I care about the most are, one, is, and let me give you three. The three I care about the most are, number one, and in no particular order, is there's a lot of deferred maintenance and aging infrastructure on our campuses. So that's one. Two is I want to give the presidents and provost a pool of funds, you know, with some guidelines so that they can recruit and retain the best faculty to stay at our universities and then also to recruit from other universities. And then lastly, I want to make sure that we don't have a situation where the university is doing things and having policies that are not making our graduation be as competitive as I think that it can be with other universities that we aspire to be in that category.
President Nagrin, you already mentioned Dr. Price and his appointment by the president-elect. Are there other things you're seeing coming out of the transition that make you feel hopeful for the future for Florida, or things that are concerning you? Obviously, there's just been about a month and a half since the election, but we're starting to see some things take shape.
I mean, I just think generally a shift in the relationship between the federal government and the state government from one of parent dictating to child to co-equals, and that we're like in Medicaid, we run that program jointly. And so I think more of a respect for states as the laboratories for reform and being open to allowing the states to make decisions so that Florida can do what's best for Florida and doesn't have to be the same as every other state.
Do you anticipate any infrastructure money coming out of this administration?
I don't know. It's too early to tell. I have heard a lot about infrastructure and particularly roads and highways and bridges. And so I think that remains to be seen. And obviously all that would have to get approved by Congress. So it's not something that I think that we can count on yet as part of our formal budget process. But I do think it's something that is definitely an item for policy discussion. And so something we'll be monitoring very closely.
At the state level, the past few years, the DOT work plan has been fully funded. Obviously, the budget outlook is looking a bit tight this year. Are you still going to advocate for a fully funded work plan or program, or where do you fall on that as far as transportation funding?
Yes. I would still want to keep our program funded.
Okay.
Can I ask you real quickly, you mentioned in your meeting with the committee chairman the oversight function, and I wanted to ask you just straightforward. Do you anticipate being more aggressive? Because one could argue that there are a lot of things that happen in the administration and the executive branch that don't receive a lot of scrutiny, whether it's contracts or things of that nature, large expenditures. In fact, one of them was the lottery this year, signed a contract worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'm just kind of curious, with you coming in, is there going to be a belief that maybe some of these things that happen in the administration deserve a bit more scrutiny than they've gotten in the past?
Well, I think that there's an appropriate role for the legislature to play in oversight of state government, and that includes, you know, agencies in the executive branch. I think that it should be done in a productive and constructive way, in a respectful way, but just as the governor has certain responsibilities under our system, including the right to veto bills and veto appropriations, I think the legislature also has an obligation to, as you were saying, to look at contracts, to look at particular actions of agencies to make sure they're actually enforcing proviso language and other things that are contained in our statutes. And I just wanted, because I only really mentioned two and a half, just a quick follow-up on the third item on universities. One way for that can be done, I think, in the shorter term and at a reasonable cost to elevate the stature and the status of our universities is enhancing our graduate programs, particularly law, business, and medicine. And so I would expect that we would want to set aside some money specifically designed to make those schools even more prominent than they already are. And the good news is we have a lot of great law schools, medical schools, and business schools in Florida. But if you look around the country, I think when you have programs where you have elite graduate programs, that actually the benefit of that inures to the undergraduate students as well, and they get the benefit of that extra emphasis.
Can you talk briefly, I know we're running out of time, but what
Speaker Corcoran, when's the last time you all talked to each other?
I mean, we talk pretty regularly, and so we get along fine, and we talk about issues that are important. Obviously, there's limitations now on you know, the forums that we can do that. But I've certainly my sense is that he's busy in his process of setting up the House, and we're setting up the Senate, and I don't anticipate that there will be any issues beyond the normal give and take that occurs between the House and the Senate, which is to be expected because they're two different bodies. So I think things are fine.
You said you talk regularly. Like, what does that mean?
I don't keep track of the number of calls. I wouldn't say once a day. I would say, you know, if we have something to discuss, either one of us can pick up the phone and talk about it.
If he said you could have a reservoir or the universities, which would you choose?
I don't think he would ask that, and I wouldn't choose between the two. All right, thank you, guys.
Thank you. And FYI, I'm sending a press breakfast invitation by Wednesday.